This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, marine biologist Helen Scales tells us about the secret life and curious afterlife of seashells in her book Spirals in Time. Helen Scales is a marine biologist, a freelance researcher and broadcaster. She appears regularly on BBC Radio 4, Sky News and the BBC World Service and has presented documentaries on topics such as whether people will ever live underwater, the science of making and surfing waves, and the intricacies of sharks' minds. Her doctorate involved searching for giant endangered fish in Borneo. She's also tagged sharks in California and once spent a year cataloguing all the marine life she could find surrounding 100 islands in the Andaman Sea. She's the author of a book about seahorses, Poseidon's Steed, and her latest book, which we're going to be talking about today, is Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells. So, Helen, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you very much. It's a huge pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Before we talk about Spirals in Time, let's talk about why you became a marine biologist.
Sure. Well, I grew up as a kid who loved the outside, loved nature and being out in sort of outside. We would go on family holidays to Cornwall. I mean, and back then I did kind of, I was very much drawn to the sea, and I did, that was my favourite place to go, was when we went to the beaches and romped around and looked for buried treasure in caves and that kind of thing, you know, and did everything you're supposed to do on beaches, make sandcastles, dig holes, went swimming in ponds and that kind of thing. But I guess kind of as a young teenager, I thought I was going to go and save the rainforest, because this was around the time, it was like the early 90s, when deforestation and like those sorts of green issues were just like headline news. So I became a vegetarian and I bugged my friends about the Amazon being burnt out for making McDonald's burgers. And then so it was all very green. And then I was about 16 and I decided, I can't remember why, but I decided I'd learn to scuba dive. A friend and me went to our local swimming pool and they ran like a scuba diving introductory thing. And we jumped in the swimming pool and I was like, this is pretty cool. Yeah, let's give this a go. So we both went along. We had like every week we would go and train in the pool. And then I did my first open water dive and it was March in Leicester in a flooded gravel pit.
Oh yeah, I know it.
It's, you know, it's a real jewel of a dive site.
And lots of people drown in that quarry.
People drown, I don't know how they managed to, because there's a decompression chamber on the side of this big lake, so you just have to literally pop yourself out of the water into it and you should be fine, but clearly no. Anyway, so it was March, it was 4 degrees centigrade, which is like if you put ice into a glass of water and stir it, that's 4 degrees. Because I did this in chemistry class the next day, I was like, look, I dived in this, I put my thermometer in, it was just freezing. But I saw a single little fish swimming through the murk of this murky gravel pit. And I was totally hooked. I don't know what it was. It was something about being in its world and kind of knowing that I was sort of, I could swim after it and if I wanted to. And I was kind of this version, a noisy, very cold version of a fish. I was completely addicted to this, like, instantly. And it all got better from there, really. So I guess my vision turned from green to blue. And that's when I realised, yes, I was going to do marine biology. That was where I was going to go. So it was sort of being in the water. And then obviously once I then got out into the actual ocean, it was just like, that was the perfect thing for me. I just felt so at home and there was so much to explore and it was just perfect. So yeah, I guess that's sort of how it happened.
And so this book ostensibly is about seashells, but really it's about, I guess, one type of seashell, or seashells that belong to mollusks. So, well, what has shells that isn't a mollusk, first of all?
There are other things. I sort of decided at the beginning of the book to be like, yeah, there are other seashells. I'm not going to talk about those. So, I mean, I guess you could think that crabs and lobsters, they have shells, they have harder outer coverings. So technically, they're seashells. We call them shellfish, so I guess they come in the same kind of category. They're different. I mean, there's a crustaceans, different group of animals, and they shed their shells frequently, so that's kind of different. There are lots of also tiny, like, photosynthetic, single-celled creatures in the sea, phytoplankton of different varieties that are, you know, green and harness the sun's energy. And they are, a lot of them make hard shells out of, some of them out of calcium carbonate, the same stuff as the mollusks we're going to talk about. Some of them are made out of silica. So really, it's just glass, actually. Things like diatoms are made of glass. So in a way, I think those are seashells too. I guess sea urchins, they've got out hard cases. That would be a seashell. I mean, there's various things you would find on a beach and that you probably, you know, could think, you'd pick it up and think, oh, this is a seashell. And that's fine. I just, you know, but the biggest group and the most diverse group are the mollusks when it comes to making shells. So, yeah.
So, I mean, it is a big and diverse group. So what is a mollusk?
So yeah, this is, what is a mollusk is a question that's really bugged scientists for ages. And I quite enjoy the fact that we weren't really sure. And, you know, back in Aristotle's time, he caught one group of the mollusks, I think back then he thought were all the soft creatures, like squid and octopus. And they are mollusks as we think of them today. So those sort of soft guys, some of them have shells on the inside. Squid and cuttlefish have shells on the inside. Octopus have mostly lost their shells. And then over time, we've kind of shoved loads of other things into the mollusk basket, like barnacles are thought to be mollusks, but they're not. They look like mollusks, but they're actually crustaceans. They are relatives of crabs, and they stick themselves to rocks, and they look very mollusky. And things like bryozoans, which are these weird creatures that grow in sort of microscopic mats across seaweeds, and they were thought to be mollusks. But we now understand that mollusks are definitely things like clams and cockles and oysters and mussels, the sort of two-shelled bivalves, as well as snails and slugs, are the gastropods, the ones that most of them have a single spiralling shell. They're also known as univalves, although I don't actually use that word in the book. Your bivalves with two shells, mm-hmm. and your univalves with one. And then you've got chitons, which are these weird ones that look a bit like a woodlouse that's been squashed flat and clamped to a rock, and they've got this series of usually eight plates across their backs, and they're quite weird. You don't often see those. They're quite cool. So yeah, so sort of snails, bivalves, chitons. You've got your cephalopods, which are the octopus, squid, that group, and then a few odd weird ones like tusk shells. They're quite nice. They do look like little miniature elephant tusks. Mm-hmm. They're little things, long and thin, stick in the seabed. So those are the kind of the main animals that now we kind of all group together to be the mollusks.
And there's a couple that don't have shells, a couple of weird ones that don't have shells. Although you've just been like, slugs don't have shells, right? You just mentioned slugs.
Slugs don't have shells, mostly. Some have little shells, or kind of inside they have shells. And I have this weird thing about being completely just disgusted by slugs that live on land. They're like the only thing in the animal kingdom I really cannot stand are slugs. But put them in the sea, and they are the same group of animals. I mean, they're sort of different, slightly different bits of the mollusk family tree, but they're all gastropods that have lost their shells. But they're beautiful, they're coloured, beautiful colours, and I don't mind them at all, I think they're lovely. But they have to live in the sea for me to like slugs. which other ones don't have shells? Let me think.
Selenogastroscordophobia, I can't even begin to
pronounce
these.
Yeah, there's two
things.
Weird ones, actually. Yeah, I kind of just mentioned them because I probably can't pronounce them either. I think they're the Selenogastras and the Cordophobiates. And they do look like worms, really. Mm-hmm. They're little shiny worms. They don't have shells. They have these sort of spicules that reflect the light. And they live in the deep sea. You don't normally see them. And they are odd, really weird things. But genetically, we can see that they are mollusks. So those are the weird ones. I've never seen one. Actually, no, I have. I've seen one in a jar at the Natural History Museum. And they just look like worms, basically.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, how many species are there? But actually, we should probably talk about, you know, this is a thing that a lot of these things live right down in the bottom of oceans. So we can't possibly tell how many species there are, can we? What's the sort of estimates?
So I guess, like with any group of animals, the problem is there isn't really a kind of central official record that you have to go to and say, I found a new mollusk and here it is, and tick it off, and everyone knows that that's what you're talking about. Because generally what happens when new species are found is that they are described in a scientific paper. And you have to actually deposit a specimen somewhere where people can go and look at it, so a museum somewhere. But that doesn't stop people from renaming things and kind of double naming and stuff like that. But people are, there's efforts now to kind of bring it all together and try and figure out what is happening, both in the mollusks and more generally. There's a thing called worms, which is, I think it's like the world, basically a register of marine species. And they're starting to do this kind of just, let's figure out what we have and see where we've kind of doubled up. And they did this recent study and showed that the species that's been named, overnamed the most, so given multiple names, multiple scientific names for what actually is one species, is a mollusk. It's a mollusk that lives on the shores of like rocky shores around the UK. It's called the rough periwinkle, and it's had like 112 names. Like, it's been way over named. So that's like, okay, so there's only one of those, not 100 of those. And they've been through, and I think they found somewhere in the region of maybe 50 or 60,000 species that have been named and found and kind of checked off now. Like, yeah, this is definitely a separate identifiable mollusk species. But the big question, which is the one I find really fascinating, is, well, if we could find them all, and ultimately, how many are there that we haven't found still? And the estimates vary so much. Like, the textbooks, it's brilliant. You look at all the kind of marine biology textbooks, and they go from, oh, yeah, probably about maybe 70,000 to 200,000. And, you know, it's like, well, how do we know? But I did actually, I spent some time speaking to one of the top experts in mollusk taxonomy and the naming of species. It's a guy called Philippe Boucher from the Natural History Museum in Paris. And he kind of spends his time basically organising expeditions in cool places of the world just to go and find mollusks. Yeah. And that's kind of his job. And he brings them back and then he hands them out to experts and says, right, tell us what we've got. But he basically is the guy who goes, right, this is how we find new species because I know how to look in the right sort of places and that kind of stuff. So he's got a real handle on what's going on. And he puts his name, or he kind of nails his colours to 200,000. Mainly from the tropics, actually. And he's done loads of studies in Papua New Guinea and bits of the oceans that are just mega, mega diverse. And he's like, yeah, he's pretty sure that if we did find them all, we could probably get to 200,000. Which is huge. It's really huge. And to put it in a bit of context, so the mollusk, it's a phylum, which is one sort of level of just sort of organisation in the animal kingdom. So compare it to another phylum, so kind of roughly equivalent, are the arthropods, which include all the insects. And they are the most diverse phylum. So they win, and there's like at least a million, and they're mostly insects, and they're mostly beetles. But mollusks come second with 200,000, and then some of them are really tiny. They're phyla that have maybe 1,000 or so species, like much, much smaller. Like us vertebrates, we're part of the chordates, and there's, I don't know in total, but I mean, the mammals, which is, you know, not even a phylum, that's much smaller. It's like maybe, I think 16,000 or something like that. Was that birds? Like it's tens of thousands. It's not hundreds of thousands. There's tons of mollusks.
And well, obviously, I mean, if I was Philippe Boucher, I'd of course be going off to like, you know, Papua New Guinea and Malaysia and putting in orders to do that. But these things are anywhere. So you're talking in the book about a terrifying slug with teeth that was found in a garden in Wales.
Yes. I'm glad I didn't find that one. It's the only predatory slug we've got in the UK. Ah, it's white and has these teeth that stand up on end like flick knives. Yeah, no, that is the cool thing about mollusks too. All you need to do is go into your local park or your back garden or go to the beach and you'll find the remains of them, you'll find their shells, and you hopefully find some living ones too. And yeah, new species do show up. It's just like one of those things of, you do just have to look in places that no one's looked, or it just happens to be that. I think actually that weird the ghost slug that we found that was found in Cardiff, I think that they think might have been introduced in like through garden pots and imported, so it might not be native to the UK, but yeah, still no one had found it, so yeah.
And I say a garden, but mollusks are a group of animals that are found like everywhere. And let's talk about some of the environments that they're in, or some of the, you know, obviously we know they're in the sea, some of the odder environments that they might be found in.
So, I mean, they evolved first in the sea, so they are sort of principally marine species. But I think, in a way, that's also how they trump the insects, because insects don't live in the sea. So that's like this huge living space which insects haven't inhabited. So they may be slightly less diverse, but mollusks have gone everywhere, because they've moved out of salt water. They've evolved to live in fresh waters, so you can find them in ponds and lakes and rivers. Like we dug a pond in our garden. We just dug a big hole, filled it with water, or laid liner and filled it with water. And stuff just arrived, which was brilliant. We put in some plants, but that was it. And just animals and things arrived, including mollusks. Like, they just showed up. And I guess they were brought on like birds' feet and stuff, like eggs and things like that. They just arrived. So we've got little cool little pond snails, and it's like, yay, they're just there. So they live in fresh waters, and then some of the slugs and snails are the only group of the mollusks that moved on to land. So we do get them living in the most extraordinary places that you wouldn't ever really imagine. So there are snails that live at the top of mountains. I mean, they do live in trees, which is quite cool. I was in West Africa a couple of years ago, and it was really dry. It hadn't rained for months. And then it rained, like it really rained one night. And I was outside having my breakfast, and this massive like tree slug was just sat on the tree next to me, and I was like, oh, hello. Like, well, did you have a good sleep? Because clearly they just sort of hide when it's dry. But you can find them in deserts as well. You can find snails that live in deserts. I mean, they mostly, when it's dry, they'll hide in their shells and kind of seal them off so that they don't dry out. And then when it does rain, they can kind of emerge and do what they need to do. And there's actually a really lovely story about a snail that was collected by the Natural History Museum in London. I don't think I put it in the book, actually. And it's quite a classic case of... So they just, these guys collected lots of mollusks. And at that point, what they did with specimens was glue them to boards. Mm-hmm. Now they put them in sort of packets and plastic packets and little drawers and stick them into cabinets. But that then they glued them to boards. And this one was glued to a board. And then about 2 years after it was collected, it woke up and wandered off. And it was alive. They hadn't realised there was a little snail hidden right inside the shell. And it apparently survived for a few years, and they still have that actual shell. I mean, it did eventually die, but they still have that actual shell. So they can survive for ages. And they found snails living miles underneath the surface of the sort of in deep, deep caves, like a mile down as well. I think it was in Croatia they found this tiny blind snail living in the midst of this crazy place underground. So they are, the only thing they haven't really done is take to the skies. Mollusks don't fly as such, but they've done everything else, and they live anywhere else.
I'm Ian Sinclair, you're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So we should bring in shells, really, because that's what the book is about. So why do they have shells?
So, yeah, so the shells of mollusks, first and foremost, it's for protection, because they're nice and hard, they're made of calcium carbonate, so essentially chalk. And it's a good way of defending themselves from getting eaten by something else. Mm-hmm. Good way of, once the ones come out on land, it's a really important way for them not to dry out. Although slugs do live on land, but they generally have to stay in damp places and they have lots of sticky mucus to kind of stop from drying out. But so shells, yeah, they are great protection. Like if anyone's ever tried to, the bivalves are the best ones. They're twin shells that clamp together. And if you've ever tried to get into an oyster, like shuck an oyster, you know how hard it is. Mm-hmm. So it's really good protection. But then the thing that I kind of really enjoyed also writing the book was uncovering all the other things that shells are used for and have evolved. And they've been really kind of flexible, and through natural selection they've been shaped into all sorts of different things. And I think that's part of the kind of success of mollusks, is that they've been able to use the shell in all sorts of different ways. Mm-hmm. So for example, a really brilliant mollusk is the chambered nautilus, which are these mollusks that look a lot like ammonites, that were this extinct group of mollusks that were amazing but have all went extinct about the same time as the dinosaurs, 65 million years ago. So they have these spiraling shells, which they live inside in the kind of final chamber of that, because it's all divided up into chambers. And that's why it's called a chambered nautilus. And if you cut one down through the middle, you see these chambers. It's very beautiful. And they fill those chambers with gas. So they live in the deep sea, like really deep down, hundreds of metres. And that gas helps to make them buoyant, mm-hmm. so that it's a bit like having, like a scuba diver wears a stab jacket, like a buoyancy device, and you can fill it with air to sort of equalise your weight to the surrounding water, mm-hmm. so you can just float. And that's sort of what the chambered nautilus does. It has this sort of internal buoyancy chamber, so that's what they use their shells for. And it makes it less hard work for them to swim around. They have use less energy to swim around, which is pretty cool. Another one of my favourites in terms of how the shells are used is a thing called the heart cockle, which are these little shells, little bivalves that live next to coral reefs and the sandy bits next to coral reefs. And they actually use their shells like little greenhouses, because they have inside their tissues, they have single-celled algae, which are kind of symbiotic. So they live there, and the algae get a nice safe place to live. And there are actually whole sort of transparent bits of the shell which let the sunlight in, so that they get lots of lovely sunlight, so they can photosynthesize and harness the sun's energy and produce sugars, which the mollusk then eats. So it's this lovely relationship between the mollusk and this algae that lives inside it, and these beautiful little shells, and they do look like little pink hearts. They're very cute.
So there's obviously a huge variety of designs of shells in terms of size, colour. Some have got, you know, spikes and things on. Some have got sort of designs, which we'll talk about in a little while. But actually, there's a limited amount of designs beneath that, isn't there? And I want to talk about this through the science that's been done on this, of people trying to sort of work out what shell designs would work and which ones wouldn't.
This is a brilliant bit of mathematics. It's again, it's one of these, a bit like, what is a mollusk? One of the big questions that bugged scientists for a long time, and sort of philosophers, was what are the mathematics behind shells? Like you say, there's all these different shapes and huge variety of shell shapes that you can find, and it goes back and back. And it was René Descartes who originally described the shape of the chambered nautilus,
yeah,
and that kind of cut through, and it's a shape you see in all sorts of parts of nature, but it's called the logarithmic spiral. So that's the kind of basis of shell making, is this, it's a shell, it's a spiral that expands at a constant rate. So essentially, just imagine you're spinning around, put a pencil on a piece of paper and spin it outwards round and round, and it gets bigger at a constant rate, which means that no matter how big it is or small it is, it's the same shape. And that was quite early on to figure out that, yeah, probably shells and certainly chambered nautiluses have this sort of basic spiral that's inside their shells. But that's only two dimensions. Mm. What about 3D? The point is there's all these beautiful three-dimensional shells. And the first guy to really kind of start thinking about this was a guy called Darcy Wentworth Thompson. This beginning of the 20th century, he was writing... He wrote a huge book called On Growth and Form, and he was really trying to get to grips with shapes throughout nature. And he wanted to understand the underlying mathematics of a splash and a deer's antler and all these different things. And one of the shapes he looked at were shells. And he came up with this idea that maybe all you need are four simple mathematical rules to describe any type of shell. And it was his kind of concept that a shell really is like a shape, maybe a circle, spinning around a three-dimensional space, like a two-dimensional circle spinning in three dimensions. And if you took that logarithmic spiral and then four, three other rules, basically determining how tall the shell is, so how quickly it falls down at central axis, big it gets, how much it kind of splays out, and also how kind of chubby it is, so how much the whorls kind of squash in together. Mm-hmm. And he thought if you kind of just took those four basic rules and tweaked them slightly, perhaps you could make any shell. And it was just an idea, though, at that point, because he didn't have any way of really testing it. So he just sort of wrote about it and drew some diagrams, and that's kind of it. And then 40 years later, a paleontologist kind of picked up these equations, a guy called David Raup. And he kind of wanted to revisit this idea of shell making. And he did something quite unusual for a paleontologist, and that was he used a computer. And back then in the 50s, the computers were massive. He was using these mainframe huge things that were originally designed for making missiles and sort of aeroplanes and things. And so I think he kind of got a bit of time on one of them overnight and said, well, I want to plug these equations in and see if I can make some shells. And he did, and it showed that Thompson was basically right, that you plug in these four basic equations and all of the shells kind of just appeared before his eyes. He called it the Museum of All Possible Shells, which I love the sort of idea of walking around this space and just seeing all these different shapes slowly. Because if you sort of change one of those parameters, it would just mean that a clam would evolve, sort of just slowly, slowly change shape, and suddenly it becomes a chambered nautilus. Mm-hmm. And it does work. And there's now videos online you can see that have been kind of... Because it's easy to do this. You can actually, there are programs you can play with and have a go at making real shells. And you see that you sort of think, oh yeah, it is kind of, if it expands that way, yeah, it does become a chambered nautilus.
Well, the clam is a great example of that, because like you picture a clam shell and you think it's just a flat thing, right? But actually, yeah, there's like a little tiny knotty bit, and it just flares out really quickly, and spirals. And it is a spiral.
Yeah, absolutely, it is a spiral. But you wouldn't. Yeah, I think until you've seen these sorts of the evolving shapes, it's hard to imagine that. But they do. And the kind of really cool thing that emerged from Raup's this output, this computer program that he did, was he realised that actually not all of those shells that he made actually exist in the natural world, or even in the fossil record. There were loads that looked like they should work. I mean, some of them probably wouldn't have worked for various reasons, like it would be a clam that wouldn't open because it's just the wrong shape. But there are plenty of fairly decent looking shells, but you don't see them in the natural world, or at least we haven't found them yet. And it kind of opened up this whole new part of biology, which is this idea of what has evolved and what's possible, and then trying to understand why certain things evolved. And there's two camps, really. Some people think that, eventually everything will evolve, and eventually we would see all of it, all possible shells. It's just a matter of time and the sort of situation where that would be useful to be that shape. And there are others who think that actually there's limits to what can evolve, and that it would never happen that way. And it's not just shells now. People are making these sort of museums for beetles and plants and phytoplankton, and looking at animals and plants in different ways. It's pretty cool.
So I want to talk about how the shells are made. eat. But before we do that, let's bring in another piece of the mollusk anatomy, which is something called the mantle. So explain to us what that is.
So the mantle is basically a soft, squishy part of a mollusk that produces the shell.
Yeah.
So if you eat, if you've ever eaten a mussel, like just normal mussels, yeah, the pink bit of flesh that you would see once it's cooked and the shell's popped open, that's the mantle. So it kind of, it covers the outside of the animal, or the inside the shell. And yeah, it's basically the bits that makes the shell in the ones that still have their shells. Mm. Mantle you'd see in other mollusks, like it's the outside of an octopus, and it's the bit that changes colour. And that, you know, and in cuttlefish as well, they use bits of their mantle to swim. Like, they have a frilly edge to their bodies, and that's their mantle just sort of stuck out. So the mantle is used, can be used for moving around and as well, but primarily it's this shell making tissue, basically. Mm.
And so how does it make the shell?
So it's a kind of ingenious way of turning ions and compounds in the water into ceramics. Mm-hmm. And so that's basically what they're doing, is taking in ions of calcium and carbonate from their diet and from the water, and secreting it into this solid and crystalline form. It's at sort of at the leading edge, the open edge of a shell, is where the shell, new shell is made. The mantle will lay down new shell material around that open mouth. And it does so kind of in stops and starts, so it doesn't continually grow, but it will kind of grow a bit when going is good and when it's warm and got lots of food. And then they'll stop and start. And that's actually, you can count, a bit like tree rings, you can count the rings in a shell. So you can take a cockle shell and pretty much work out how old it is, because it'll have like a fast growing season in the summer when it's growing lots, and then slow growth will slow down and you'll get a sort of thinner band. So you can count how old a mollusk is from those sorts of bands in its shell. And they keep their shells their whole life. So they're not like crabs that will grow too big and then they leave their shell behind and kind of cast it off and molt and then make a new one. They keep it. So if you look at the inside, take a snail shell, a spiralling snail shell, and look at the tiny bit right in the middle, that's the shell it had when it was a baby. That's its baby shell. And it will just have grown it bigger and bigger as it got older. And yeah, and the process right at that leading edge, it's basically the sort of, it's essentially that the mantle squeezes these ions into a little gap between itself and the shell, and that sort of forms a matrix. And there's also protein in there as well. I think it depends on the mollusk, but there's a protein scaffold that gets put down first, and then it fills in the gaps with calcium carbonate, and it solidifies and it gets bigger.
Yeah. I mentioned that often mollusks have patterned shells, which at first glance we might think are for like camouflage or something like that, and no doubt some of them are. And you mentioned also the cuttlefish and octopuses, which, you know, can change colour and things. It's obviously a very advanced form of it. But often these shells are covered over, either with part of the mantle or with like weed or, you know, some sort of thing, and therefore you can't see that. So why do we think some mollusks have patterned shells, even though that patterning might be hidden?
It's a brilliant piece of kind of investigation that for a long time scientists just didn't know why they had these patterns, and it was almost explained like it was natural selection was left to run riot, and it didn't really matter what patterns they had, and they just kind of went crazy. And that's, you see certain groups of mollusks, like the cone shells, have these beautiful intricate patterns which are just really just so complex. You think, well, you know, it must have had some sort of purpose. There must be some reason for having this. But then cone snails live most of their lives buried in the sand and nothing sees them. So it's, and they have this layer. Actually, they do have a layer of protein that grows on the outside of some shells called the periostracum. In some of them it looks kind of like hairy, a sort of hairy layer. So when that's there, yeah, you can't see the patterns. But then a couple of scientists in California came up with a theory that maybe what shells are doing is they're leaving themselves a message about where they've got to in that shell-making process. Because I said already that it's stop and start. So they're not continually making their shell. And so their theory is actually that the mantle can kind of lick over the edge of the open edge of the shell where it's growing and taste, sort of chemically taste, this pattern that they've laid down, and then line themselves up to be in the right place to carry on making more shell. Otherwise, it would all just go a bit bonkers, and the shape would be lost, and the patterns, would be all over the place as well. So that's the theory. And actually, they haven't really tested this yet. It seems like it's likely. There's lots of nerves that you see in the mantle that could be sensory, so they could be detecting these pigments. We don't actually know the pigments, what they are. Mm-hmm. Like, no one even really knows what is painting shells and all these colours. It's like a big mystery still. No one's looked into it. But again, it's a little bit like these mathematical rules that make the shape of the shell. It seems that they're actually fairly simple mathematics that could explain these beautiful patterns. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of these simple, almost like a simple linear array of rules about how, well, if this cell here is switched on for pigment production, then it tells the neighbouring cells to either switch on or switch off. And it kind of, you get these patterns that out of really simple rules kind of generate huge complexity. And a lot of the shells patterns that we see in cone snails, you can actually explain through these sorts of interactions going on, possibly, you know, in their sort of, in the mantle. It could be that it's just sort of, originally people thought maybe it was passages of hormones, but now it's probably more likely to be under nervous control, so the nerves that kind of actually generate, sort of self-generate these patterns. But I just love this idea of mollusks leaving themselves messages across their shells, like, here we are, carry on from here. And actually, it could lead into some new interesting parts of research as well. I mean, because you could think, oh, whatever, who cares about how mollusks paint themselves? But it is this idea of them being able to assess the past and predict the future, and you know, it's a simple nervous array, so perhaps it could help us understand more about more complex brains and nervous systems. Mm-hmm. That, you know, perhaps it gives us an insight into how memories are formed in more complex things like humans. But yeah, it's pretty cool.
Just one more question on mollusk biology then, before we move on. And again, it's sort of leading on from this idea that they follow certain mathematical rules, one of which is that the vast majority of mollusks are, for want of a better way of describing it, right-handed. So as a member of a small persecuted minority of left-handed people, I want to know what's wrong with left-handed mollusks.
Weirdly, as well, it's the same proportion of snails are left-handed as humans are left-handed. Mm-hmm. So that's odd, we don't know why. But we do know why it's not very good being a left-handed snail. They don't get to have sex enough, which is very important when you're a snail and anything else, really. So the theories are, there's been lots of really, frankly, bonkers studies to try and understand why being left coiling or right coiling is advantageous. And it basically comes down to the problem of if you're a snail and your shell doesn't match your partner's, then you just aren't going to be able to fit the right bits in the right places, because it's not only their shells that are spinning one way, but their bodies are also asymmetrical. So most gastropods, which is mostly what we're talking about here with these spiralling shells, most of the ones that live in the sea are they have separate sexes, they're male and female. On land, they tend to be hermaphrodites, so they both have each sets of sexual organs, but they will take turns in being male and female, so they will still mate up and partner. So it is important that they get it right. And there's just been studies where people have taken snails that are left and right coiling and put them together in a box and left them alone, and that usually is enough to make more snails. Give them lots of lettuce and they'll be fine. But when they're left and right coiling, they just cannot figure it out. Like, one way of mating for snails is face to face, so they kind of they face each other, but the male's penis just doesn't manage to make it into the female's paw, which is what they need to do to transfer the sperm, and it just doesn't work. So it's like, there you go, I'm afraid. It just happens that the majority of species at the moment, and we don't really know why it went that way, but it just happens that right is the kind of fashionable thing to do right now for snails. And it might change. But the little left-handers, I mean, there are some species that have evolved to be left-handed, and sometimes it is advantageous. Like, for example, there's an island off Japan where there are these crazy snakes that have evolved to sneak up on snails and bite them from one side, and they've kind of got lopsided fangs so that they actually can really easily get their teeth into a right coiling snail. But if they go to a left coiling snail, it just pings off, or they just can't get any purchase on these left coiling snails. So those ones survive actually, and then do quite well. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are cases where it's really good to be a left coiling snail, but on the whole they tend to be a bit lonely and they don't tend to have many babies, and that's what really matters.
Thank you. listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Helen Scales, and we're talking about her book Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells. And Helen, in this half, I want to move away from talking about mollusk biology and look more at the way human beings have used shells and mollusks in culture and art. But before we do that, before we look at some good art, I happen to know that you're something of a connoisseur of terrible shell art, so let's talk about that for a moment.
Yes. I paid a couple of visits to the Natural History Museum in London to meet the curators and to chat about mollusks and so on, and see their fantastic collections. But when you walk into the mollusk section, which is underneath the dinosaurs, you go through a little side door and they lead you downstairs. It's all very exciting, and you get to see the kind of back rooms where so much of the collections are kept that you don't get to see normally. But the first thing you see when you walk into the mollusk section is this big cabinet, which they call their Cabinet of Horrors, and it's full of kind of kitschy shell craft stuff that they've been given over the years. And I feel kind of bad that in the book I really slated this, because then I went back and I actually think that the curators do quite like this stuff. They feel, you know, fairly kind of close to all these knickknacks that have been given to them, but I kind of slated it a bit, and because the problem I have with all of this stuff is that so we're talking, you know, like a cowrie shell with googly eyes and a little pair of glasses to make it look like a turtle with a hat. And, you know, you buy this on holiday or whatever by the beach. Or, you know, a bunch of shells stuck together to look like a frog smoking a cigar. And it's just, it's not that I don't have a sense of humour about these things, but I just feel that somehow we are forgetting the true beauty of shells.
A cowrie shell is a beautiful thing. It doesn't need googly eyes to improve it.
Exactly. I just feel like it's turning them into something that I don't think they need to be. And so I actually did a bit of research online. I've been doing hunting around for the ugliest pictures I can find. And my favourite is these people on... there's a lady on eBay selling these just grotesque kind of human head sort of busts, ceramic busts, covered in just the most ugly collection of shells, and then there's like diamond sort of encrusted seahorse here and pearls here, and she's charging vast sums of money for these, and I don't know who is buying them. It's quite amazing to me. So yeah, I guess I'm on a bit of a crusade to kind of reinstate the beauty and the elegance in shells.
This is not a new thing though. I mean, there's a reproduced in the book, there's some really great photographs in the book, but one of them is of an Aztec serpent that's made of sort of like, you know, turquoise, but also shells. So the people have been doing... it's a very beautiful thing, of course, but they've been doing, like, bad shell art for a long time.
It's true. We've been using shells for a very long time. And it's obvious why we use them as a kind of material, because they're shiny and white, and that's a really significant colour in many ways. So there's lots of symbolism in that kind of... the colour of birth and death, depending on where you are. They're shiny, beautiful, pretty colours. So yeah, I get it. I get why shells have been used. And I just think maybe lately, maybe people are still doing nice things somewhere with shells, but perhaps we used to be a bit more, I don't know, a bit more tasteful about it.
I presume you've been to the Shell Grotto.
I have been to various shell grottos.
You've been to the Margate?
I haven't, and I should.
It's very impressive.
I really should, because that one we don't even know why it was built, do we? It was sort of a big mystery.
Well, it's not that big a mystery.
Oh, isn't it?
I mean, it has this idea that it's some ancient mystery thing, but really, it was obviously built by some Victorian guy for fun or whatever, you know. But it's very impressive.
It's huge, I hear.
Yeah,
isn't
it's big.
It
it's a big thing. It's an impressive thing.
Yeah, and kind of, I'm sure, pretty ugly too. I mean, the ones I've been to, you kind of, I guess, you do go, oh yeah, it's impressive. Someone dug a hole and they got loads of shells, and they've arranged them and they've stuck them on the walls. And yeah, okay, yeah, I get that, I suppose. It's sort of, it is trying to recreate this sort of exotic idea of a space. Just so many shells.
Well, I said we've been doing this for a very long time, so let's perhaps talk about how long have we been doing it. You talk in this book about, you know, remains found that over 100,000 years old of human beings using shells in some sort of decorative way.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of the significance of it, really, is that this, the first use of shells as jewellery, so they've been found with holes in and wear marks, and that suggest they've been strung on a string and worn. Actually, they've been worn for a while next to each other, and some have pigment rubbed into them, like ochre pigments. But it dates back, the dates keep getting put further and further back. I think originally it was 60,000 years, and then 80, and now like maybe 125,000 years ago in Africa, both in the north and in the south. So way apart, people who could surely have nothing to do with each other back then were using shells in this symbolic way. And it's not like the tools that early humans evolved that were useful for killing stuff and making food and whatever. There was no purpose, really, no practical purpose to these shells. So it really represents a kind of dawn of that bit of the human brain, which is thinking about things in an abstract way and kind of making sense of the world and maybe identifying themselves as a particular group of people or something was going on. We don't know what. And that's, you know, we probably won't ever really know what they thought these shells were and whatever, but they clearly were significant and they were using them in ways that, you know, we still do today. We still wear, you know, people still find people wearing shells as necklaces. So yeah, pretty crazy to think it's been going on pretty much since the beginning of modern thought, really.
And you talk about this rather extraordinary find of like mass graves off of the coast of Bulgaria as well. What's that?
Yeah, that's brilliant. So that's a kind of shell called the Spondylus shell. And the kind of significance of this finding, I think it was in the 70s, they dug up this city of the dead and found all these graves from a period about 7,000 years ago. So this is, you know, a leap forward from this African stuff, but still a long, long time ago. And it was a period of time we referred to as Old Europe. And up until that point, it was thought that Old Europe was kind of an egalitarian society. These were kind of pastoralists moving out of the Middle East. You know, they'd figured out some crops and they domesticated some of the livestock. But there was up until that point no evidence that there were basically any sort of hierarchies in society. And then they found these graves full of gold treasure and lots of just clearly opulent stuff was going on. And so clearly there were big, rich, fat blokes at the top who were in charge of everybody else. There was no doubt that there was this hierarchy. And amongst the gold, so this was the oldest gold hoard that had been found, I think still today, so 7,000 years old. And there was the one guy, the chief of the of these old Europeans who was in a grave, like just he was wearing gold earrings and gold kneecaps and just had gold clothes, gold penis sheath, as you do, and it clearly is a gold penis sheath, you see the pictures and that's what it was. But he also had lots of jewellery made of this shell called Spondylus. It's a white shell and they carved it into things like bracelets. And he was wearing this bracelet around his upper arm, which weirdly was clearly kind of had been crafted really carefully by somebody and then broken deliberately and then fixed with a gold plate. Which is weird, but kind of fascinating. And there's other objects as well. They found these rings, these Spondylus bangles, in lots of different graves, actually all across Europe now. And they came from the Mediterranean, so they were being traded a huge long distance, especially back then. And none of them were broken. And it's this idea of maybe it was something about, oh, I don't know, there's all theories of, you know, perfect things couldn't go to heaven, and or perhaps these shells were broken, these bangles were broken and handed out to the family. And there's that sort of hint that people kind of took a piece of shell and kept it there like for ages and then perhaps put them back together when that friend was buried. And there's some odd things going on, but really fascinating. And this shell really was clearly very highly valued. It could have been, you know, as valuable as the gold stuff.
I want to bring us on to the cowrie shells. So let's talk about the cowrie shells, which are from the Maldives. And this is an incredible story, so I'll let you tell that story from the beginning. So let's start in the Maldives with people discovering cowrie shells.
Right, yeah, so cowries are these little gastropods, little snails. There's lots of different species, but one in particular lives in the Maldives, in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And it'll give it away a little bit to tell you that they're called the money cowrie. That's their kind of common name. And, you know, way back, I think sort of starting, we've got evidence certainly in the 15th century, in India they were used as kind of a common currency, just for small, sort of trading in small goods. I think people, you know, in marketplaces and that kind of thing, were using these cowrie shells as money. And they were coming from the Maldives. They were being traded under very strict control of the monarchs in the Maldives. They would parcel them up. Actually, they catch them in a really interesting way, which was really cool. The way that these things were gathered, it wasn't that people just went out and kind of picked them from the sea. They would throw palm leaves into the shallow waters around the atolls in sort of these beautiful, clear tropical waters you get in the Maldives. You chuck a palm leaf in, leave it for a few weeks, and the cowries crawl into the leaves and sort of find it as a nice place to hide. Then all you need to do is just drag the leaves back out of the sea, leave them on the... leave them on the sand for a bit and all the cowries drop off, dig a big hole, chuck the cowries in, and they'll just kind of rot away, and then you've got lovely shells left. So that's how they did it. Bundled them up, traded them up to India in exchange for rice and cloth and things like that. So that was the kind of the original small trade in cowries. And shells are used as money all over the place. So that's kind of a common thing, that these shells were used as currencies. Like, you know, Chinese character for money is, I think, the symbol for cowries. So they were using cowries as well. So that's a thing that happened. And then the whole thing really changed when European traders showed up. So we're talking kind of 16th, 17th century. And they were coming to Asia, so further beyond the Maldives. They were going to get tea and spices and all those kind of high-priced silks and that kind of thing, and bringing them back to Europe. But they would stop off in the Maldives on the way. And they basically kind of realised that there were these shells, and made this distant connection to the ultimate destination, these shells, which was West Africa. So it was a long, long way away. But these European traders figured that actually what they could do is load up on really cheap cowries. Actually, in India, they wouldn't collect them probably directly from the Maldives. They probably got them from India. And they were cheap because they weren't really worth that much. And they would sail all the way around Africa, thousands and thousands of miles, back to London, and sell these cowries to slave traders, who would then put them back in their ships, sail back down the coast to West Africa, and exchange the shells for humans, for human life. So they'd figured out there had been this trickle of shells coming across Africa from India, we think, and shells were being used as a sort of really low-grade sort of local currency, but not very much. And it was really the traders who came along and were like, hey, guys, we've got these shells, and you kind of do value them. How about we swap them for people? And this whole thing just exploded, and it was like this single trade, like the only place these shells came from for the money wasn't the Maldives. It was this complete kind of monopoly on where this money came from. Only came from the Maldives. Went on these crazy long journeys, and then eventually were exchanged for hundreds of thousands of human lives. And billions of shells were traded. And then they ended up, the sort of irony at the end of the story is that these human slaves were then sent, most of them were sent off to the Caribbean to work sugar plantations. The sugar that they were growing went back to London, and that sugar sweetened the tea that had originally been bought from Asia, packed amongst the shells that their lives had been bought for. So there's this kind of weird, massive, long-distance trade that was going on with shells and people and tea and sugar. Just totally tragic. Just this idea that you could swap humans for shells. It was just
I mean, it almost seems like you can't imagine that the slave trade could get any worse in the telling, but to find out that they didn't even pay proper money, and they weren't giving the slave traders in Africa gold for these slaves, they were giving them shells. It's such an amazing story.
I'm Andrew Muller. Check out the growing Little Atoms media empire at littleatoms.com.
I want us to finish off talking about, I mean, loosely, still really, how human culture has affected mollusks in terms of ecological change, in terms of climate change, warming oceans, you know, acidification of oceans and things. Let's talk about what's going on, what's happening with the mollusks.
Yeah, they're kind of, I guess that's another reason why it made sense to me to write the book. Not that I wanted it to be this kind of hard-hitting, oh gosh, everything's going to pot environmental book, but actually they do represent a lot of the problems in the natural world and in the oceans. Like, there's a lot of things happening to mollusks that are representative of a broader sort of problems. They're being overfished, overharvested. There are populations that are kind of basically extinct. I mean, there used to be massive oyster reefs around the UK. We used to have the native oyster that was hugely abundant, like massively abundant, and the Victorians were scoffing them by the million, and they've basically gone now. And the reason they've gone is a combination of overharvesting plus pollution and disease as well. So there is a weird kind of, at some point sort of in the late 19th century, a disease arrived in the UK. We don't really still know what it was, but it pretty much wiped out, the remaining oysters were wiped out by this disease, which were already stressed because they were overharvested, and the Industrial Revolution was really getting going and kind of polluting the seas as well. So there's definitely kind of those big environmental problems the mollusks face, of those sorts of things. And then they do face this very specific problem, this side effect of climate change that is very particular to things that have anything to do with calcium carbonate in the seas, and that's ocean acidification. So this is the idea that aside from any change in temperature and warming because of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that we've been making, it also dissolves in the ocean. And actually that's a good thing, because I think something like a third of all the carbon dioxide ever made by human activities has been absorbed into the oceans. So if it wasn't for the oceans, climate change would already be unbearably worse than it is now, because it would all just still be in the atmosphere. But that carbon dioxide doesn't just sit there in the oceans unnoticed. It essentially forms a form of acid. It reacts with water and forms mild acid, which messes around with ocean chemistry in various complicated ways, but basically means that it is becoming harder for things with calcium carbonate shells and skeletons to get along. And we know this is happening. It's just chemistry. There's no question about it. The oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 200 years ago. If nothing changes, they're going to be 150% more acidic in the next 100 years or so. So that's just a fact. That's not questioned. And the reason it's a problem for mollusks in particular is because their shells basically start dissolving in this more acidic water. It isn't actually acid. It's not that the seas are acidic. It's just that they're more acidic than they used to be. So their shells are becoming more damaged, or they could become harder for mollusks to make their shells and to repair them. And there's lots of predictions and studies showing that this could be a problem in the future, although not for all the species of mollusks. Some seem to maybe have mechanisms which mean they can cope. Like cuttlefish, for example, just seem to keep on going. Like you take a cuttlefish, plop it in an aquarium tank and pump it full of carbon dioxide at increasingly high levels, and it just keeps on going. It's like, bring it on, I'm fine, I'm really fine, in fact, I'm better than I was. And then there are others that just go, oh, God, I can't grow, and just die. Or put that and warming as well. So often it's a combined thing, you know, it's higher temperatures and lower pH, and they just don't survive. Or their juvenile stages are often the sensitive ones. The youngsters don't survive. So there's a big question about what's going to happen in the future with mollusks and other things like coral reefs as well. They also have calcium carbonate skeletons. That's a big problem. And there's one group of mollusks, actually, that I write about in the book, partly because I just really wanted to learn more about them and to see them for myself, because they just seemed like someone had made them up and it couldn't possibly be true, that there are such things as sea butterflies, which are tiny sea snails that have evolved not a single foot that they creep around on the seabed like most of them do, but they have they've evolved to split their feet into two little wings and they fly around the open sea. And they have tiny, tiny, delicate, transparent shells. And because of that, sea butterflies are probably one of the most vulnerable groups to ocean acidification, because they just don't have much to lose in the first place. And so there's lots of studies going on in labs and also in the wild, looking at, there's areas of the ocean which are more acidic already. It's not just that it's uniform everywhere, there are some bits where it's worse. And they already are seeing, we think, the signs of sea butterfly shells starting to get cracked and kind of just not doing as well. And apart from them just being really beautiful creatures, we think they probably play a really important part in the ocean ecosystems. They are that kind of link between the lower levels of like the plankton, the phytoplankton that are producing food from the sunlight, and they eat, you know, these are the animals that eat those, and then other animals eat the sea butterflies. So they could be really abundant in certain areas and form food for whales and birds and fish and things. And so if the sea butterflies do start having problems, it could cause big problems elsewhere. We don't know for sure, but it's kind of worrying that could be the way things are going.
So as well as all of that happening, you know, the causes of global warming on mollusk population, I mean, there are other things, like, you know, we mentioned earlier that, you know, we have no idea how many species there are, and there are species out there that we haven't found yet, and, you know, there'll be deforestation going on, which is probably destroying some species of snails that we'll never discover. And, you know, we could perhaps think, so what? But, you know, finish off telling us the story of one particular snail, the core snail, and its venom, and how that is, well, what it's being used for, possibly, and why it's important that we find weird snails in the jungle.
Very important, the cone snail. Those are sea snails.
Oh,
I'm sure there's
snails.
Lots of ones in the jungle too, but the sea ones are really good. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There's tons of cool stuff that we're finding in the mollusk world that's just being really, kind of selfishly, really useful for people. So if just the kind of mind-boggling brilliance and diversity is not enough to convince us that we need to protect the oceans and mollusks and everything else, then, you know, they can be useful for us. And cone snails are a brilliant example of that. So these shells that live in mostly in the tropics, the ones with beautiful patterns that we now think we can explain through computer automaton equations. But they have something else up their sleeve, which is that they are very, very poisonous. And there are some species, I should say cone snails, we think are the most diverse genus. So you've got species and then genus. It's the kind of levels of organisation. So humans are Homo sapiens and Homo's our genus. So their genus is probably the most diverse in the oceans. It's like, I think there's 800 species, which is huge. like, of all the animals that live in the sea, there could be, like, this genus is huge for cone snails. So they're pretty awesome to start with. But there are some species that have the ability, if you were to get a sting from one of them, it could kill you. They fire out, they have their teeth are highly adapted, they fill them with poison and spit them out. The idea is they're actually mostly catching fish, but the idea that a slow-moving snail can catch a fish that should just swim off is quite bizarre. Though usually the fish are asleep at the time, so they are sort of cheating, but you don't want them to wake up and swim off. But they have these poisons, and they're incredibly complex. Slowly, scientists have been kind of unpicking the complexity of cone snail venom, finding out that they are the most complex venoms on the planet. Each shot of venom has probably got maybe 200 different compounds, and they're tiny little peptides, little subunits of proteins, which we now call conotoxins. And each one has this exquisitely specific effect on the body of fish, because they've evolved to be able to catch fish, and that's because they're vertebrates. They also affect us as vertebrates too. And so scientists have found that if you put these conotoxins into different parts of human sensory systems, it has exquisitely specific effects, and actually that's really useful for studying brains and nerves and how they work. Because what you can do is sort of switch bits of the nervous system off and say, okay, what defect does this have, by switching off the channels that are kind of just conducting nerves around the body, basically, but in very, very specific ways. So it's this incredibly useful research tool, which is one thing. And then there are applications to make drugs and medicines and painkillers out of these. That's the first thing we've really done with cone snail venom, to make this very specific painkiller that basically blocks the passage of nerves from the sensory nerves to the brain. Mm-hmm. So if you have pain, it just cuts off that communication channel. And it's being used. It's actually being used, I think, mainly in the States to treat people with chronic pain. And it's better than morphine. It's less addictive, and it has fewer side effects. And so that's the first one. But there's tons of other stuff in development. They're looking at, like, recently they discovered actually that cone snails not only use these toxins, but they have a form of weaponized insulin, which they use. They put out puffs of insulin to these sleeping fish, which then gives them this kind of they just knocks them out, basically. It gives them this hyperglycemic shock, so they just fall unconscious, and that gives the snail time to slowly absorb this fish into its body and digest it. And that again is this really interesting small molecule which is having this effect of insulin. So who knows what we'll find in that, and what use for diabetes research and treatment and all that kind of stuff. And there's so many, like I say, there's 800 species of cone snail, we think, maybe more. And we've only really looked at a handful of species in terms of the venoms they have. So, you know, what else have we still got to find? It's amazing. And cone snails are threatened. Like, they are ones that in some places have only got really small ranges. So, you know, if they go in that particular island, then that's it. You know, if that species is gone. So we really do need to look after the cone snails.
I've been talking to Helen Scales. We've been talking about her book Spirals in Time, The Secret Life and Curious Afterlife of Seashells, which is out now from Bloomsbury Sigma Books. So, Helen, thank you so much for coming in and telling me about it.
Thank you for having me. It's been a huge pleasure. Thanks.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, new journalism and more on our relaunched website littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.